This is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre.
Hey, what's up, loyalists? So if you guys were listening last week, you heard part one of our interview, a very funny interview, with comic and actor, producer, a former Simpsons writer, and a fellow Planet of the Apes fanatic, Dana Gould. We had a wonderful time, and we frankly couldn't make just one episode out of it because it would have required major edits and cutting, and we felt the content was too strong, and we wanted to share all of it with you guys. So, without further ado, here is part two, installment two, or Beneath the GGACP with Dana Gould, if you like. So, enjoy.
And I think Don Adams was one of those people that got into that 70s look of the sideburns.
Yeah.
And the whole 70s.
So did Peter Lawford.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
with
yeah.
The Nehru and the turtlenecks.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Salt and Pepper. I mean, the movie Salt and Pepper with Peter and Sammy is so flawless.
And a movie we talk about a lot on this show, and that's Skidoo.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Jesus.
Drew's favorite.
of course. But yeah. It's really that, and that's also like the it's why I'm glad Mad Men ended when it did. I didn't want to see Don in a big, you know, Richard Nixon bad polyester jacket. But also it's the difference between the Twilight Zone and the Night Gallery. Like the Twilight Zone has that sort of eternal look because it's the late 50s, early 60s, the classic suits, classic haircuts. Everybody is, it's still, with the exception of like people having wet, shiny hair, they could walk off that movie, walk down the street, pretty much be unbothered. But the Night Gallery was 69 to 73, and it's all like, it's like Burt Convy playing the devil in like a velour jumpsuit. it's like everything is wrong. Leonard Nimoy plays a haunted tree, but he's had the giant mutton chops and the Seinfeld puffy shirt, unironically.
My podcast partner does not dig the Night Gallery.
Yeah, well, they're very, it's as we said, the Night Gallery is, the Night Gallery is better in theory than in practice.
Well, the Vincent Price one is good.
There's a handful of good ones. Yeah. And Rod Serling in the terrible, like the Tony Roberts fro. He's got the Tony Roberts fro from Playing Again, Sam, strangling it down with a brush.
The perm.
I thought everything that was wrong with 70s television was in the Night Gallery.
I can't argue your point.
It's a good point.
Leonard Nimoy staring down a tiger that's clearly not in the same shot.
And you could see when they would do blackouts laughing.
And Serling hated it. Serling controlled The Tonight Show. It was his, The Tonight Show, The Twilight Zone. It would be great if he controlled The Tonight Show.
That'd be great. I'd watch that.
But Serling was in charge of The Twilight Zone. He was just the host of The Night Gallery. He didn't want the headaches. And the guy that he originally agreed to let run it, a guy named Melvin Laird, turned it into that. And it's like, and Serling still wanted to do quality television. They're like, nah, we got a better idea. Adam West is going to play Dracula. It's going to be great.
You're going to love it. And when they do those blackouts, there must have been at least 10 of them where an actor would be dressed as Dracula and he'd be at the blood bank and he'd go, I'd like to make a withdrawal. And then all it needed was da 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 da.
They should have gotten Stuart Margolin and just done the Love American style blackout.
All the jokes were from, and I'm going to bet you had this book, Barnabas Collins in a Funny Vein. It was the Dark Shadows joke book.
Wow.
I'm looking right at it.
Wow. He's got it in his living room. Look at this. He's gotten out of the chair. He's retrieving the joke book. It really exists.
I have an old paperback book display.
Oh, there's Jonathan Frid.
Look at that.
Dark Shadows Cookbook.
Barnabas Collins in a Funny Vein.
Oh, and God.
The Dark Shadows Cookbook.
My girlfriend found the Dark Shadows Cookbook. She gave me that for Christmas. How's that for a find?
That's a lovely gift.
Yeah. Wow. How's that for probably no? That's when you know you're with the right person.
Gil, what was that magazine you're always talking about on the show that used to do those corny horror jokes?
Well, there was Famous Monsters of Film. Line.
Yeah, Famous Monsters. Forrest Ackerman was always the punniest man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Horrorwood, California.
And I heard him, maybe even saw, Forrest Ackerman wrote a sex letter.
Yes. Yes.
Some girl like a quarter of his age.
Yes. This is a true story.
And saying things like, and using those horrible puns.
Yes. He was a dirty bird. He was a very dirty bird.
Like, let's keep abreast of the situation.
Do you remember Heidi? Do you remember Heidi Saha?
Oh, my God. That was deranged. An underage girl.
That was fucking deranged. We have to talk about Heidi Saha, I'll let you take the lead on it.
It was a pedophile's dream, that girl.
It was Forry Ackerman and Isaac Asimov discovered this 13, 14-year-old, 12-year-old girl at a convention. And she was the precursor of a cosplayer. She would go to all these Famous Monsters conventions, and she was a little girl.
They had her in sexy outfits all the time.
They did a one-shot magazine for her.
Oh, this is new on me.
Look it up. I mean, the magazine is worth so much money on like eBay it's creepy, but it's not like there's nothing shown, but it's awful. But Heidi Saha. But literally, they would even write, they would put her picture in Famous Monsters and then put like, what a lucky chair to be sat upon by Heidi Saha.
Yeah.
Like, it was just these awful.
Wow.
They should have all been. I mean, nowadays, the magazine would have closed and they'd all be in jail.
Oh, yeah. It is one of those things where you look back and you go, yeah, how did that happen?
Yeah, like perfectly acceptable pedophilia was going on in that magazine.
That's such a seldom used term.
he's exactly right.
Family friendly pedophilia.
Do you know Dan Clowes? The cartoonist?
Yeah. The cartoonist, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was the one. We were talking about Forrest Ackerman, and I had completely forgotten about Heidi Saha. He was the one that reminded me of Heidi Saha, and we both were like, we just started screaming like, how did that happen?
And then another one of those time and space wasters in Famous Monsters was, I don't know if the girl's name was also Heidi or something, but she was the girl who haunted Bela Lugosi, and she was the girl with the yellow eyes, which, you know, Bela Lugosi never fucking talked about. They invented it. Fill up the article, they'd have pictures of him from one of his movies and go, could he be thinking of the girl with the yellow eyes in this scene?
Do you know why that was in the magazine?
Yeah.
Because you asked for it.
Oh, my God.
There you go.
That was so, that was like when Dear Abby would say, by popular demand, we're reprinting this letter.
Do you have the parodies of Famous Monsters? There were two. I'll send them to you.
There was Monsters to Laugh With.
No. There's a guy. God, I'm blanking on his name, and I'm blanking on the name of the magazine, but I have them, and I'll send them to Frank to show you.
Please do. That's what I was referencing, Gilbert. I thought you were talking about Monsters to Laugh With when you were talking about those bad puns.
This was called, there was a guy that did two pristine, perfect parodies of Famous Monsters, and it's just stuff like a picture of a weird guy in a fright wig with a perfect font, Norman Lerner will not die, like the way they
I remember the Monster Times.
This is a parody magazine. I'm gonna send it to you,
a spoof
that you asked for. It was such a fucking waste. Bullshit. Waste of time.
It was the way you'd burn off your Bernard Jukes images.
Yeah, they would say, like, Jim Johnson from Indiana says, can you print a picture of Boris Karloff as Frankenstein? And they'd have it there. And I think, is there really a Jim Johnson? And yeah. Is he asking for this?
Are you saying they fake the letters like Penthouse Forum?
Yeah.
Yes. I never thought I'd be writing this letter.
Yeah. Darlene Feinberg of St. Paul, Minnesota wants to see Chuck Connors fighting a triceratops. Well, here you are.
I think it's in the original 1 million BC. A triceratops is attacking a caveman because they lived in the same time period.
Of course.
And triceratops were...
Well, the Earth is only 5,000 years old.
Some people believe that.
Triceratops were vicious meat-eating animals. And look, nobody knows what dinosaurs sounded like, but in 1 million B.C., he's barking like a dog. The triceratops is attacking.
Oh, that's the greatest thing.
Hilarious. Hilarious. By the way, do you know who's a fan of the Dr. Goldfoot movies is Steven Van Zandt?
Of course he is.
Yes, we talked to him about that. Yes, he has a Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine poster in his office.
Of course he is.
Oh, and have you met... I met Price twice.
I met him once, but I didn't... So you met him in normal show business, I'm assuming.
Yes.
I met him as a college freshman in Massachusetts.
Wow.
I was a theater major for about 2 weeks at the University of Massachusetts before I switched majors. But he came and spoke to our class, and it was a small class, and I went up and met him later. He seemed pretty cool.
I remember I was a regular on Thick of the Night.
Sure you were. I remember that.
And I was doing some bit where I was doing voices, and afterwards I sit down on the panel, and I feel a big hand on my shoulder, and I turn around, it's Vincent Price, and he says, I loved your Peter Lorre.
How about that?
And then years later, I was at a horror convention, and I went over, I saw Vincent Price there, and I said, you probably don't remember this, but we met on Thick of the Night. And he says, oh, yes, that was a terrible show. We will return to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast after this.
Here's a great parallel story if we have time.
Yeah, we got time.
Okay. So when I worked at The Simpsons, it was shot on the Fox. We worked, our offices were on the Fox lot. And for lunch, I would just get off the lot and go someplace to get away for an hour. And there was a Toys R Us on Pico and La Cienega. And sometimes I just go down to the Toys R Us and look at what toys were, you know, being who I am. I had just performed at the Saturn Awards, which is the Sci-Fi Fantasy Awards. And I did my Vincent Price bit, which was my impression of Vincent Price. And it was just pointing out that he has two voices. He's got the smooth voice. I understand that your car broke down outside. I insist that you spend the night here in the house. And then the high-pitched nerve, but don't talk to any of the paintings. Okay, so I'm in Toys R Us, and I hear, oh, you're Dana. You did Vincent Price at the Saturn Awards. And I turn around, and it's Mark Hamill.
Wow.
Oh.
And I'm stunned. It's like seeing a deer in your yard. It's like, you're not supposed to be here. You're not supposed to be in Toys R Us. And he goes, oh, that was really funny. And he's the nice. I don't know if you've ever had him on. We'd love to have him. He's so great. He's so normal and approachable and funny. And he does amazing impressions. Does the best Harrison Ford impression you've ever heard.
Yeah, heard it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Great.
It's amazing.
Great imitation.
And so we just started talking. And he said, you know, he goes, I love your Vincent Price. I know Vincent. The Tingler is one of my favorite movies. And when I met Vincent Price, I said, you know, I love The Tingler. And Vincent Price said, isn't that a marvelous piece of rubbish? And then Mark Hamill goes like, you know, when I've done some movies that I'm not crazy proud of, like Corvette Summer, you know, could have been a little better. And when people say they love it, I always go, wasn't that a marvelous piece of rubbish? Because I don't know what else to say.
It's a pretty good Mark Hamill impression, Dana.
I'm trying to remember him, but it was he's one of those people you meet and you're like, I can't really name anybody that was disappointing, but you do meet these people and they, like, you know, Mark Hamill, Adam West, Charlton Heston, Adam West,
yeah,
that are so great when you meet them. And I think it's
Adam was a gem.
Adam was amazing. We had him on The Simpsons, and it was a flashback to a Krusty the Clown. Batman was guest starring on Krusty the Clown. Krusty the Clown was playing a villain on Batman. And we had done the episode and we was doing his voice. And we say to Adam, and I didn't need to be in the record, but it was Adam West. So I went to the record. You
know? Right, like, of course.
We're going to meet Adam West. And we say to him, all right, we get everything. It's great. You did beautiful. Thank you so much. We just need some, Krusty has tied you up. And we just need you struggling, like some grunts, like you're struggling in vain. Just give us some wild line grunting. And he goes, okay. And then he said, we didn't give him this line. He did it. He went, struggling in vain. And we just clapped. Like, and
that's,
I think,
so good.
It's because also, like, he knew he was Adam West.
Yep.
But I also think, like, he knew what he meant. Like, he knew who he was. And, like, I think he knew that if he was shitty to somebody, it would be devastating to them. And he was a great enough person that he cared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was one of those guys that debunks the don't meet your heroes.
Great. Really well put. Really well put.
Delightful
really
guy.
Well put. And, you know, another we talked about earlier, Carlin was the same way. Like, Carlin, I'd been with him in several situations where we're talking and somebody just interrupts. Like, I saw you in Minneapolis in 1973. And he was always great. And he would say, like, this moment is not about me. This moment's about them.
Well, he had that Danny Kaye thing haunting him from when he was a child.
I know that story, and you're right.
Oh, yes, by the stage door.
Yeah, bless him.
Hey, everybody we've had on this show, there are two names that always pop up as people couldn't stand them. One was Danny Kaye. And the other was Joey Bishop.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Well, I was just watching it's the Tonight Show's 10th anniversary with Carson. And it's Jack Benny, Joey Bishop, Jerry Lewis, everybody. It's on YouTube. And you can just tell Joey Bishop is a dick.
That's what we hear.
And he's giving Jack Benny shit for blowing cigarette smoke in his face. And it's just like, shut up. That's like, you shouldn't be here. Like,
and somebody said they were doing one episode of the Joey Bishop show, and he was playing a dual role in this episode as him and his brother. And Joey Bishop yelled at the director, how come my brother is getting the funny lines?
That's it, yeah, Bill Bursky and Denoff. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's good just, stuff.
That's just maddening. Shatner gives people a hard time too. There's very few stories like, I met William Shatner. He was lovely.
I hate to say it, but he was nice to Gilbert.
No, good. I'm glad. Yeah.
So now I could say, well, he was always nice to me.
He was always nice. I have that with people. I have that. Yeah. Well, he's nice to me.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Ward Whipple, please, please.
Ward Whipple is not a real person.
Oh, he might be.
That's from Dudley Do-Right.
It's a Frank Nelson character.
Yeah, Ward Whipple from Green Acres calls and says.
He says, I need to have another price comparison, dueling Vincent Prices. When Dana's in town. You guys feel like doing this one? Real quick, Gilbert Darrah did the printout for you.
Sure.
We call this price comparison.
Price comparison.
Sir.
And I've got to tell you the name. It's like an old British show where Vincent Price and Roddy McDowall end up in a fist fight on a boat.
All right, we're going to find it.
And I know from our listeners, at least one person is going to send that. We'll tweet it.
For sure. Our listeners are obsessed.
My friend Ken Daly, who sent it to me, said that the fight should have cat noises underneath it.
two great Batman villains, by the way, speaking of Adam West.
Yes.
And there was a short-lived TV show. I don't know if they were in an antique store owners or what it was, but I think it was Vincent Price and Peter Lorre.
Wow.
Some old TV.
All right,
show.
We'll have somebody look that up. Let's try this Vincent Price bit. Gil, you start us off. This is from The Fly.
You've committed murder just as much as Celine did. You killed a fly with a human head. She killed a human with a fly head. No, Helene and Andre believed in the sacredness of life. They wouldn't harm anything, not even a fly.
This is from Return of the Fly now, Dana.
Here passes from this earth Helene Delambre, widow of my brother Andre, whom I love deeply and hopelessly. She was destroyed in the end by dreadful memories, a recollection of horrors that didn't dim as the years went on, but instead grew monstrously and left her mind shocked and unsteady so that death, when it came, was a blessed release.
Somewhere in the human mind lies the key to our existence. Our ancestors tried to find it, to open the door that separates us from our creator. If you believe, dear friend Seska, you are gullible. Can you look around this world and believe in the goodness of a god who rules it? Famine, war, disease, and death, they rule the world.
This is from House, that was Mask of the Red Death, and this is from House of Wax.
Mask of the Red Death, torn from today's headlines.
There you go.
People say they can see my Marie Antoinette breathe, that her breasts rises and falls. Look at her eyes. They follow you wherever you go. She's very real to me. But they're made of glass. More is the pity the exact size and color of the original. They're inserted into the sockets from inside by way of the hollow neck before the head is attached to the body. Forgive me, my dear, for discussing your intimate secrets. I'm sorry. I lose myself at times.
Ladies and gentlemen, do not panic, but scream. Scream for your lives. The tingler is loose in the theater. We will now resume the showing of the movie.
And finally, from the abominable Dr. Fibes.
Perhaps your hands will shake and he too will die under your knife. A few remaining minutes are all you have because of the acid reaches him. He will have a face like mine. Don't cry upon God, Dr. Vesalius. He's on my side. He led me, showed me the way in my quest for vengeance. This is very hard to say quest for vengeance. It's very hard to underplay that role.
Yes.
you can't Michael Corleone. I'm on a quest for vengeance. It's just that it just doesn't play.
And what happened to an Al Pacino could underplay parts.
Well, that was the thing. Al Pacino, Nicolas Cage, Vincent Price, they all become Vincent Price. They talk very quietly, and then they yell! It's the same. They have two speeds. They get really quiet, and then they scream.
What's the story of you using Lawrence Talbot as a pseudonym on The Simpsons? Just you goofing with yourself?
No.
To see how many people would pick up on it?
Nope. It's a very weird story. I have three daughters, and they're all adopted from China. And we had adopted our first daughter, and we were just preparing to go to China to adopt our second daughter. And the episode that I had written was called Goo Goo Guy Pan, and it was basically the story of the first time I went to China to adopt a baby. And there were some jokes about China in there, because it was The Simpsons. And we were afraid that they would see it because they're everywhere. We were in China in a room and in a meeting about just the paperwork for the baby. And we looked, and on the computer were our income taxes, it's like that we had never sent. So I didn't want to piss off anybody from China. So I put a fake name on the China adoption Simpsons episode. So when I get there, they didn't give me like a lobster. There's your baby. Take it. So no, it's a baby. Take it. So I didn't want to offend anybody. So I said, well, what's a pseudonym? Well, Lawrence Talbot is
nice work.
The most famous alter ego in movies. And then after it ran a couple times, they put my name back on it once I was safe with that. And that baby, I'm proud to say, is now 16 years old. And I think she's still here in the house.
You got to respect a man that puts Lawrence Talbot on his script, Gilbert.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you want, in the time that we have left, Dana?
Vincent Price did the first version of I Am Legend, written by Richard Matheson, called The Last Man on Earth. And Richard Matheson was not happy with how it came out. And so he changed his name. If you have the poster, the screenplay is written by Logan Swanson, which is
I like it.
There was I just remember a part in The Wolfman where Chaney says, I don't understand, and if it's something I work on with my hands, I could understand it. And he says, oh, he asked, do you believe in a man can turn into a werewolf? And Claude Rains goes, well, there are certain old beliefs and superstitions and old wives' tales, but a man actually turning into a wolf? No, it's madness.
It's also two things. One, the first time he meets Gwen Conliff in that movie, it's so creepy because he fully admits, I was looking at you through my telescope. I saw your bedroom.
Yes. Shut up. They would not allow that in a movie now.
And also it's like, how is he Claude Rains' son?
Yeah.
He's 6'5". He's as American as the rooster on the cornflakes box. Like, hey, pop. Nice to see you. And his father's a 5'3", but hello, laddie.
Well, that's when we had Donnie Donegan on the show.
Yes.
More absurd than Donnie Donegan playing Basil Rathbone.
He had a curly blonde hair, and he sounded like Gomer Pyle.
Yes, he did sound like Gomer Pyle.
And he was Basil Rathbone's son.
He's from Texas.
Dad. A monster's right. In the house.
It's so true. It's fine. Well, it's like we were watching not too long ago, Touch of Evil. It's like, who should play the Mexican detective? Charlton Heston, obviously. Who else would play a Mexican detective?
Oh, there was a Mr. Moto film. So already you got Peter Lorre as Asian. But he's questioning a Mexican storekeeper, and the Mexican storekeeper is John Carradine.
That's great.
Who looks and sounds more Mexican than John Carradine?
In the time left, Dana, do you want to talk about Bob Hope?
Sure.
Do you have a shortened version of that story? I hate to shorten it because it's so.
No,
wonderful.
I can plug something. I'll fit a plug in.
Please do.
So Bobcat Goldthwait and I, who says hello, Gilbert? I was actually just talking to him before I...
Oh, tell him I said hi.
We did a tour in February of 2020, and the future looked great. And we filmed the shows, and we were going to make it a concert piece, and then COVID happened, and we ended up making it a documentary about our friendship and our sort of whatever. And I talk about when I worked with Bob Hope, and we found the footage of this, which I had, which is, I was on the second to last Bob Hope special, and I had to do a commercial with Bob. And the whole point of the commercial was I have my arm around him, and he's just, as I said, it felt like a sweater full of light bulbs.
I love
just
that line. My arm.
Yeah. a tube sock full of dying goldfish. And I just have my arm, and I'm supposed to say, hi, I'm Dana Gould. Join me and my new best friend on his comedy special this Thursday on NBC. And Bob turns to me and goes, hey, I love this kid. Didn't she used to be my caddy? And I do like a take.
That's a whack.
And the first take.
Oh, Lord.
And the first take, I do my line and he goes, and he's not, and I'm Gilbert, I'm sure you've had situations like this. I'm literally standing next to him. I have my arm around him. And he is not acknowledging me. to him, I'm just like a crow. I'm like, no interest in me at all. I don't blame you. It was 90-10 at that point.
And a skit we spoke about many times.
Oh, I sent it to Dana.
I sent it to old Jack Frost.
Jack Frost.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Unreal.
How did they? So in this one, the first take, he took some me and he goes, "Yeah, let this kid, didn't you to be my cargo?" And then he just didn't say caddy. His brain went, "I'm not saying caddy today. I'm saying cuckoo."
I love this kid. Didn't you to be my cuckoo?
So they go, all right, let's do it again. And he goes, what? Goes, we're going to go again, Bob.
Why?
And the guy goes, peanuts. Huh? Because he had been eating peanuts before. Because you get some peanuts on your chin, Bob. So they send, which he didn't, but they needed to do another take. So they send over a guy that has to wipe non-existent peanuts off his chin.
Oh, jeez.
And then the makeup has to touch it up. And then we did the second take. I don't know how I have this footage, but I do.
Oh, bless you.
It's in the doc. And the whole time, and then he says his line, he's like, yeah, let this kid, didn't you to be my caddy? And I do a take, the cut, and he goes, he always plays that hurt take. It's like, yeah, I'm just, he says, what, you gonna shit on me? Like the one thing, the one thing you say to me is, hey, fuck this guy.
And Bob Hope never tried to hide the fact that he was reading the cue cards.
Oh, God.
No, by this time, he had an earpiece and his daughter was reading his lines into his ear. So
yeah, like, Linda.
I think that you.
You know, that footage is great because the web has mostly been scrubbed of that stuff. I can't find, aside from Bob Jack Frost, which is gold, it's very hard to find the latter day specials.
Yeah.
When he was cadaverous.
Yeah. As my friend Ken Daly says, when he had sad monkey eyes.
Tube sock full of dying goldfish.
And what's weird is way back by the later Hope Crosby movies, he was already developing that kind of Bob Hope.
Kind of. Well, it's so funny. It's like in Road Trip when they do the Steve Coogan movie where he does the different versions of Michael Caine. It's the same with Bob Hope. Hey, young Bob Hope. And then kind of, hey, Reagan. Once Reagan became president, you got kind of lazy. Once you're friends with the president.
How did you guys end up? Did you say goodbye? Did you just walk away when you
were? Oh, no, I just walked away. You can see it. It's in the foot. I just kind of get up and look around and walk away. Like, doesn't matter.
You didn't say, Mr. Hope, this was a pleasure.
No, nope. Didn't. Didn't dare.
Hilarious. Oh, God. Yeah.
Didn't I was because it wasn't a pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. Bob Hope is one of those people.
You must have had you must have done that, Gilbert. You must have worked with him or had some of those where it's like a big like Burl or somebody that's like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
You never worked with Hope, though, Gilbert.
No. No stinking Jews. They're taking our society apart.
Yeah. Hey, these guys love money, huh?
I wish this podcast were visual.
I tell these Jews, they really like money.
They own all the banks and news media. That's wild, isn't it?
Was it Frank? Was it you that was telling me what he would do in Vietnam on the USO shows?
Ed Weinberger told us. Yeah.
Bob Hope, I always heard, you know, he'd fight out these, you know, Raquel Welch
and Margaret.
And he threatened them with, if they didn't fuck him, he'd leave them in Vietnam.
I believe. Yeah.
They'd all get on the plane and leave her behind in the jungles of Vietnam.
I hope that story's not apocryphal.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's horrible for all involved, but God, please let it be true.
Yes, yes. We will return to Gilbert Gottfried's amazing, colossal podcast, but first, a word from our sponsor.
In the time left, Dana, I'm going to give you your choice.
Oh, gosh.
We just talked to Lorraine about the black cat. We love to talk about the black cat. Or would you rather talk about the scandals involving Lionel Atwill and or Albert Dekker?
Oh, well, let's go to the black cat. Since Lorraine covered the black cat. And by the way, how awesome is Lorraine Newman?
She's the best. Happy
She's
birthday
so
today.
Great. Today's
is
her
it
birthday.
Her birthday
today?
It is indeed.
Oh,
yes.
My God. I'm going to email her. Again.
Her and Willis O'Brien.
That is insane. I did not know that.
Yes. And King Kong was first shown on this date in 1933 at Radio City.
Really? And who here has held King Kong in their hands? Just me.
Oh, thanks to your friend Bob.
Thanks to my friend Bob Burns.
Yeah. We don't have to talk about the black cat, but we'll talk about
it. Lionel Atwill, you know, there are degree, there are people earn titles. You know, you're in the military, you're a colonel, or if you're a policeman, you're an officer. Lionel had one of those titles that you used to get in show business, Orgy Master. he was famous. He was a dirty, dirty bird. And he would throw these orgies, but I just love the title. He was an orgy master. I demand to speak to the orgy master. to be the Karen at an orgy. I'd like to speak to the orgy master, please.
Funny.
No, I'll wait. Yeah, he got in a lot of trouble, Lionel Atwill, and Albert Dekker too, for the
Dr. Cyclops.
Albert Dekker, that was the weirdest death of all time. He was hanging in the shower.
He was kneeling in a tub.
Kneeling in a tub in a corset, was it?
Yeah, with hypodermics in his arms.
And there were obscene words and drawings all over his body, and he was bound and gagged. And the police called it a suicide.
Suicide.
That's like, fuck it, suicide.
Yeah, because back then it was just like, it's my and you can really, if you ever watch the old Dragnets, for the 67 to 70 Dragnets.
They're great.
I have in that room Jack Webb's whiskey set that story really quick. I started dating after my divorce, and finally you meet somebody else, and I started dating my girlfriend. I hate being a man of my age saying girlfriend because she's a woman. You know, she's a fully adult woman, and we live together in a very responsible relationship.
Your lady friend.
Partner, I guess, will be married.
Yeah. See, so you turn gay over the years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Your partner.
My partner. my she, Dana. So anyway, I show, and we both get really, she got really into Dragnet, loves Jack Webb. And so I was on the road, and Allison Martino, if you know who that is.
Oh, she's great.
Yeah,
she's great.
Allison Martino emails me, there's a Jack Webb estate sale. Like, he lived in this house in Toluca Lake, and one day he just moved out of it. He, like, packed up a briefcase and walked out and left everything. And then, like, Tito Puente moved in, but he didn't change anything. He just kept all the Jack stuff. And then it's been sitting dormant. Somebody was. So, like, they're selling all this stuff. So my girlfriend goes, and there's a long line of people waiting to get in. And she's looking around. She's very tall. She's very attractive. I'm going to date her until she wises up. And but she sees these two cops just walking right into the house. So she just gets behind them and walks in with them and goes right in.
Wow.
Went right. She works for a whiskey company. So she went right to the whiskey decanters and got them. So we have Jack Webb's bar set. But she says the attitude of cops in those days, and this is how it ties to Albert Dekker. Like, whenever a woman is talking, Joe Friday is just so impatiently suffering whatever they have to say. Like, when a guy is talking, he's, yes, sir. Yeah. Well, we have those problems, sir. Yes, sir. Well, the police officer has to follow the rule. And whenever a woman is talking, she's like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He just goes, why are you making noise with your word hole? Like, he just, he said, yeah, it's a suicide. Yeah, it's a suicide. Let's go. Let's wrap it up.
I would like to go through the Gould collectibles one day.
Oh yeah, it's.
Let's tell people about the graphic novel, because we mentioned it in the intro, and our fans will be interested.
Oh well, you know, as I said, I'm a big Planet of the Apes fan, and I've been paid to write things in my life. And one day, like out of the blue, I got a call from this graphic novel company and said, hey, we have the rights to Rod Serling's first draft of Planet of the Apes, which is very different from the movie that was made eventually. He took the novel, which is a very satirical, it was written by Pierre Boulle, and it was very much like Jonathan Swift. It's a very satirical novel. It doesn't really, it's not the same thing. And he made it up. It was right around the time he wrote 7 Days in May, Rod Serling, and he really broke it down into a political thriller. It's very much like 7 Days in May with apes in it. There's a lot of, it takes place in a modern day city. They have cars, they have helicopters. There's a lot of meetings. There's a lot of hush, hush, political skullduggery going on. And then that script was rewritten by Michael Wilson, and that became the movie that we saw. So it's a very different story worth seeing. So I got a call one day and they said, yeah, we have the rights to adapt this as a graphic novel. And I thought they were going to say, would you write the foreword or something? And they just said, would you like to write it? And I was, yes.
How flattering. Like, good
yeah.
for you.
And I was, and it wasn't even like, it was like, well, let's talk about money. I'll pay you whatever you want. I'll do it. And I had to learn how to write a graphic novel, which is a very different form than screenplay. It's you know, the dialogue has to fit into a bubble. You get one action per panel. You have to decide how many panels per page. I mean, there's a lot of, it's very, very work intensive. But I'm a giant Rod Serling fan. He's the reason I became a writer. And what I did not anticipate was the script is really big. He was the Aaron Sorkin of his day. He could write speeches. Mm-hmm. And I had to cut a ton of it. And so every day I would get up, sit at my computer and start cutting Rod Serling's words.
Oh, fascinating.
It was excruciating. And I just had this angry smoking ghost over my shoulder. Why are you cutting that? That's great. What are you doing? That's great. Why are you cutting that? Why are you cutting that?
And you met Anne, and she's great.
I spoke to her on the phone.
Oh, she's wonderful.
She could be nicer.
There was a scene that in one of the Twilight Zones that he reused in Planet of the Apes. And that was the one, it may have had Claude Akins, and also that old German actor, Oscar Hermike or something like that.
Oscar Beregi?
Beregi. Oscar Beregi.
Yeah.
Well, we've broken the seal on Oscar Beregi references.
Well, the Oscar Hermoka references are still to come.
That was... They're in like kept in a booth to wake up in the future.
Yes.
And then there's around and like a rock has fallen on one of the cases and the guy looks like he's 200.
Yep, that's right. And he did put that in the Planet of the Apes. And that's not in the movie. That's not in the book. He did put that. And the surprise ending, there's an episode of The Twilight Zone. I think it's called I Shot an Arrow into the Air, where a guy is in a rocket ship and he's crashed in the desert and the other astronaut thinks that they're never going to survive and there's no water. And he ends up killing the other astronaut so he can have his water. And then he walks over the hill and sees a sign that says entering Nevada and that that he was on Earth the whole time. That ending was a Twilight Zone.
How many science fiction films have there been? Oh, it's such a strange planet where this goes on that. What is the name of this planet? Earth.
Yes. And so many planets with breathable oxygen. And
I just saw that one with Roddy McDowall where he's in the zoo.
In the zoo, yeah.
Where he's in the alien zoo. It's so good.
No, there's one that they turn out to be like Adam and Eve, where it's Charles Bronson and Elizabeth Montgomery.
It's a right.
Good one, too.
And Roddy McDowall is in the pilot of the Night Gallery. And
yeah, it's a good
amazing.
It's good. It's good.
Oh, Potter Boy.
Yes. Who is it?
Ozzie Davis, I think.
Ozzie Davis.
Yeah. That's and, good. The pilot's good. It's better than the show.
Steven Spielberg's first job.
And they had like, the Joan Rivers one.
Joan Bennett. Joan Crawford.
The Joan Rivers Night Gallery was really scary.
Edgar, I sold my eyes.
With Tom Bosley.
All right, here's the weird swirling Joan Rivers connection.
Uh-oh.
I'm on the right podcast.
You are. The panty dropper.
Rod Serling was hired in 1964 to write they were doing specials to raise awareness for the United Nations. And in 1964, Rod was hired to write the first one, and it was a parody of a Christmas carol called Carol for Another Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it with Sterling Hayden.
With Sterling Hayden and Robert Shaw.
Robert Shaw.
The Ghost of Christmas Future.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Sterling Hayden was supposed to play Quentin Jaws. He turned it down and they gave it to Robert Shaw and they act together. And Peter Sellers is in it.
Yes.
And it was Sterling Hayden and Peter Sellers.
Ben Gazzara is in it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it was Hayden and Sellers in the same year as Strangelove.
Weird.
In a TV movie that Rod Serling wrote. It's incredibly dark.
It's a real curio with an anti-war message.
Yeah, anti-war, but it's incredibly dark, incredibly bleak. And when the United Nations Fund said, like, we want to take this money and we want to give it and we want to use it to do something on television that will raise awareness for the United Nations mission, it was Edgar, Joan Rivers' husband, was the PR guy they hired that said, I have an idea. Let's go to ABC or whatever network it was, CBS, and see if they'll do something. And he was the guy that came up with the idea.
Dana Gould makes the best connections in the business.
That's what they call me, the Segway King.
Yeah, he can connect Joan Rivers to a Rod Serling Christmas movie.
And I just remembered there was also on the Night Gallery TV series, in the special, there was that one with Richard Kiley as an escaped Nazi.
Yeah, that's
yes,
a good one.
Yes,
that's a good
yeah.
one.
Yeah. It's basically a remake of a Twilight Zone. They did a lot of that. Serling had a terrible, he was in World War II. He was only 5'4", but somehow got into the paratroopers, was stranded on an island in the South Pacific. They were on starvation rations, literally like had the thing of the movie where like a Japanese soldier was pointing a gun at him and he heard a shot, thought it was him, and it was his friend killing the Japanese soldier.
Yeah.
And then they get discovered and the supply plane drops supplies. The parachute breaks and the supplies land on his friend and kill him in front of him.
Oh, like,
I know. It was the worst luck in the world. But it was so he really did go through hell.
His hatred for war and violence, informed his work for years.
And as we were talking about, was one of the only people at the time to appreciate the lunacy of Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, yeah. Well, we discussed that. We discussed that with Ann.
But it's true. It's like at Hogan. Now you look at Hogan's Heroes and you're like, Jesus Christ.
Yes.
What the hell is this? But at the time, like, it's funny.
Well, and you and I talked about that. It's just, like it's almost as if they thought, oh, we'll make Stalag 17 into a series.
Yeah,
there was something legitimate about the idea to them. Gilbert.
Yeah.
Gilbert's been doing that in his act for years.
No, I know it's true. But you couldn't do it now, but you could do it then. But even Serling at the time was like, this is fucking insane.
Yeah. He wasn't wrong.
Nazis aren't funny. Prison camps, death camps aren't funny.
There was a Twilight, another with Oscar Beraki, where he was a Nazi, a high-ranking Nazi official, and there's a concentration camp that's still standing.
Yes, this is the one I was thinking of. Yeah,
yes.
And he goes, yeah.
I think it's called Welcome to Deathhead or something.
Yes.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
That sounds right. Dana, we got to get out of here. We could go on forever.
Check out Hanging with Dr. Z on YouTube.
Hanging with Dr. Z on YouTube. And also I will tell our listeners that they should stay for the closing credits of all of every episode, because Hervé Villechaize is credited on this week's show, as well as Irwin Allen and Swifty Lazar.
Yeah. We rack our brains. We actually had a Sidney Korshak reference. We worked really hard.
There's a discussion of Joey Heatherton and also Elvis's chimp.
There's
something for everybody. And DanaGould.com and your wonderful podcast, which you're still doing. And you and Bobcat have the project coming.
Yeah, when? Joyride. It'll be coming out soon, I hope.
Wonderful. Anything else?
You know, we're two middle-aged white guys, and it's time our voice was heard.
Can I make you take us out with a little Adam West? With a little more Adam West?
Oh yeah, well when Rob and I worked with Rob Cohen and I worked with Adam West, and then about a year later we went to just see him at a celebrity show, and we were rehearsing how we would reintroduce ourselves, like, hi, we did a thing called Super Adventure Team, which was a parody of the Thunderbirds.
Oh yeah, very good.
And we had his voice on it, and so we're like, hi, I'm sure you don't remember. And he looked up and saw us approaching the table, and he went, here comes trouble. How are you two geniuses? But we were, made my life. It's like Adam West looked up and recognized me. I was like, okay, I'm done.
Meeting Adam at the convention, Gilbert, in the Valley all those years ago?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Oh, the creepiest part of that convention was there was a table that had...
That's a high bar, too.
Yeah. Was it the Beverly Garland? You know that show.
Yeah, Beverly Garland, yeah.
It had both Snow White and Cruella de Vil, and they're both 1,000.
Yeah.
Someone says to Snow White, he says, oh, this is... you have something in common with this man. They're introducing me, and they say... He was in a Walt Disney film called Aladdin, and she grabs my arm in like a death grip, digging her nails into my arm, and goes, someday my prince will come when all my... And I figured, oh, she's just honoring me because we both did a Disney film. And she sings the entire song. And I'm going, she doesn't know who the fuck I am or what they said about Aladdin.
Adriana Castellotti.
She's just...
She's gone now.
I was at the same show, saw Jonathan Harris, and it was right when they were getting ready to do the new Lost in Space with Gary Oldman and William Hurt. And I said, so Mr. Harris, are you in the movie? Are you in the Lost in Space movie? And he looks up and he goes, they offered me a cameo. A cameo. And then he said, I swear to God, he goes, not this chicken sister.
No, I'm using that.
And then I used to bring Myla Nurmi to those to Vampira. Sign autographs. Yeah, speaking of Igor, I was her Igor for many years. And one time I sat her down and I would, you know, get her situated. And then I'd go off and make sure she had everything she wanted. We were friends. I helped her out. And they one time she was sat next to Gary Busey, or as I called him at that time, Gary Drug Abusey. And he was out of his mind. And Myla, who did the perfect thing, like he was doing something and she like laughed and then turned to me perfectly like, get me the hell away from him.
We can relate to that one. Dana, wonderful.
Great to see you guys.
It's so great to see you. And we could go on and on forever. Gilbert, let this man get to his collection of Jack Webb tumblers.
I've got to go play with my... I'm going to email Lorraine right now. Wish her happy birthday.
We will do the same. Gilbert's... We're going to sign off now.
All right. This has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre and our friend Dana Gould.
Dana, always a pleasure.
Oh, this is so fun. I could go all night.
Come back. We'll do an entire George Zucco episode.
I could go all night, and this is the only situation in which I could go all night.
Thanks, pal. See you on the thread.
Bye. Yes, indeed. Say hi to your wife, Gilbert. I thought you
were late. Hi. Okay.
Bye, Dana. Thanks. Thanks, man.
Two of us. No boogeyman is greater than the two of us. The people scream about the team of Karloff and Price. Although we're as nice as can be, my buddy and me, there's just the two of us, and we'll be always traveling on. The two of us. There's lots of gore in pictures for the two of us. He used to shine as Frankenstein and I was the fly. They forced us to die every time to pay for the crime. They killed the two of us, but we'll be always traveling on.